Hello, my name is Ryan Kramer, and today I'm going to be discussing state drug policies and the consequences, how the criminal justice system may perpetuate social disadvantage among vulnerable populations. Research suggests that many of the social conditions associated with involvement in the criminal justice system are the same as those associated with STD risk. We will focus on socioeconomic status and drug use. Involvement with the criminal justice system has also been shown to affect socioeconomic status and drug use post-release. Research suggests that other risk factors for STD are affected by involvement with the criminal justice system, namely risky sexual behaviors, community-level sex ratio imbalances, and disruption of sexual networks. Additionally, a fundamental concept within the field of criminal justice is recidivism, or relapse in a criminal behavior. In addition to punishing socially undesirable behaviors, one of the primary goals of the criminal justice system is reforming the individual by deterring future unlawful behaviors. With respect to drug-related crimes, recidivism is particularly common, and recidivism may be positively associated with more severe punishment. So here's a possible simplified model for thinking about this complex set of factors and the interaction between the criminal justice system and STD risk. The risk factors are shown at top and bottom, the outcomes at left and right, and the arrows indicate the direction of the effect. As you can see, socioeconomic status and drug use are risk factors for both STD and criminal justice system interactions, but criminal justice system interaction is also a risk factor for lower socioeconomic status and drug use. Risky sexual behaviors, community sex ratio imbalances, and sexual networks are affected by the criminal justice system, and they are also STD risk factors. As you can see, what emerges is a loop that connects all of these factors and ends with STD risk. So in terms of the relevant laws, while federal drug-related criminal laws do exist, the regulation of drug possession is largely a question of state criminal law, and as such, the consequences of criminal convictions vary widely across states. Most criminal laws grant judges a lot of discretion in sentencing, based on aggravating and mitigating factors. A common theme among drug-related crimes, however, are mandatory minimum sentences that require sentencing that involves at least a minimum duration of incarceration. Mandatory minimums have been criticized in individual cases as being harsh in application due to their not taking into account mitigating factors. Even so, criminal convictions can have non-criminal impacts that last a lifetime, including access to public assistance programs, consideration of criminal history when applying for jobs, voting rights, among many others. So as I've discussed, the criminal justice system involvement and STD risk share a common set of risk factors, and we are not aware of any systematic review of state criminal laws as they relate to social determinants of health and STD risk. Our objective is to illustrate how state criminal laws may be a social determinant of health and affect STD risk. The CDC Division of STD Prevention, or DSTDP, and the Public Health Management Corporation, or PHMC, identified criminal justice-related legal issues hypothesized to be a social determinant of health and affect STD risk. PHMC identified, collected, and coded laws related to criminal possession of marijuana, crack cocaine, and methamphetamines, as well as the rights affected by criminal convictions, known as the collateral consequences of conviction, as of November 2015. DSTDP then summarized these laws and analyzed how these laws could play a role as a social determinant of health and affect STD risk. So our first category of legal measures were state criminal drug possession laws. These included, first, type of drug, including crack cocaine and methamphetamines due to their association with STD morbidity, and marijuana because it is the most commonly used illegal drug in the United States. Second, the minimum amount of drug that must be possessed before a state will punish possession in weight. Third, mandatory minimum punishments. This is the minimum that a judge must sentence for possession, and we coded this as non-incarceration, likely a fine, probation, or a drug cessation program, incarceration measured in duration, and no mandatory minimum. Fourth, we examine the classification of the mandatory minimum punishment in terms of whether it is a misdemeanor, felony, or civil infraction. A civil infraction is a punishment imposed by the government that is not classified as a crime. And finally, enhancements for a third drug possession offense. These are legal provisions that explicitly provide for more severe punishment for so-called repeat offenders. While states may impose enhanced penalties after any number of subsequent offenses, States generally who do provide for these penalties generally do so after a third offense. These are what are commonly referred to as three strikes laws. Our second category of legal measures are called collateral consequences of conviction, laws that affect legal rights based on a criminal conviction and are often a social determinant of health. These include, first, laws that permanently ban individuals from public assistance programs based on a felony drug conviction. Specifically, these laws involve temporary assistance for needy families, or TANF, which provides cash assistance for low-income families for limited purposes, such as child care and job training, and the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, commonly referred to as food stamps. Second, state laws that require public housing programs to consider criminal history when assessing an applicant. Third, whether a misdemeanor criminal conviction results in mandatory ineligibility from a license to practice a regulated profession. We then group these limitations by occupational category in order to facilitate comparisons across states. And finally, so-called ban the box laws, which prohibit employers from asking about criminal history during the job application process. We coded for whether such a limitation exists and whether it applies to public sector employers or private sector employers or both. The first legal variable we examined was the minimum punishable amount of possessed marijuana in weight. As shown in red, 40 states punish for any possessed amount. In yellow, 7 states punish possession of more than 1 gram. And for reference, one marijuana cigarette is between 1/2 and 1 gram of marijuana. And finally, in green, 4 states plus D.C. punish possession of 2 grams or more. So quickly, you may be wondering about the recent states that have legalized marijuana. The reason that these states don't necessarily look unique on this map is because whereas legalization is a newer trend where there's extensive regulation of the marijuana industry from beginning to end, decriminalization has been a trend with these states for several decades. And these states do not prosecute for small amounts of marijuana possession, and yet marijuana remains otherwise illegal. So even where marijuana is legalized, there's still a maximum amount that you can be possessed before you criminally prosecuted for such possession. Additionally, I'm not reviewing these results for crack cocaine and methamphetamines because any possessed amount of these drugs in states are punishable by law. So this table summarizes the number of states that meet our coding criteria for the other drug possession sentencing variables of interest, namely the type of crime for a first and third possession conviction and then the mandatory minimum penalties for the first and third possession conviction by type of drug. Well, there's a lot of information in this table. I'd like to make just a few general observations. First, on both a first and third offense, many more states mandatorily sentence crack cocaine and methamphetamine possession as a felony than they do for marijuana possession. Aside from being a more severe criminal penalty, felony convictions carry with them many non-criminal consequences as well. Similarly, many more states have a mandatory minimum that involves incarceration for crack cocaine and methamphetamines than they do for marijuana. So here we calculated the difference between a first and third possession conviction for each of our variables, as shown in red for an increase and green for a decrease. So for instance, a first-time marijuana possession is considered an infraction in 14 states. A third-time marijuana possession conviction is considered an infraction in 12 states for a net negative difference of 2 states. So as states move from 1 conviction to 3 convictions across all 3 drugs, states predictably decrease in the number of low-level mandatory sentences, infractions and misdemeanors at top, and non-incarceration at bottom, and increase in the number of high-level mandatory sentences, felonies, and incarceration. Finally, while crack cocaine and methamphetamines were generally sentenced very similarly, there are some interesting differences that are hard to explain, such as more severe crack cocaine sentencing on first conviction and more severe methamphetamines sentencing on a third conviction. Now for the collateral consequences of conviction. First, does a felony drug conviction result in permanent ineligibility from TANF and or SNAP? In 34 states, as shown in green, TANF and SNAP eligibility is unaffected by a felony drug conviction. In one state, in yellow, a felony drug conviction will result in ineligibility from SNAP, but it will not affect eligibility for TANF. In 6 states, in blue, a felony drug conviction will result in ineligibility for TANF, but will not affect eligibility for SNAP. And in 10 states, in red, a felony drug conviction will result in permanent ineligibility for both TANF and SNAP. In terms of public housing, only 7 states' laws require that an applicant's criminal history be considered when determining eligibility for public housing. However, these were also high population states that included approximately 24% of the United States population in 2015. For occupational licensure, states range from limiting licensure based on a misdemeanor criminal conviction for no occupations to limiting licensure for occupations within 9 of the categories that we analyzed. As shown in green, 6 states did not have a law limiting licensure based on any of the occupational categories that we analyzed. In blue, 29 states limited licensure within 1 to 3 occupational categories. In yellow, 9 states limited licensure within 4 to 6 occupational categories. And in red, 4 states limited licensure within 7 to 9 occupational categories. So we also looked at this from the perspective of which categories states most commonly limited licensure based on a criminal conviction. 2 categories stood out as encompassing nearly half of states. First, occupational licensure for personal care and service occupations was limited in 28 states. Occupations within this category included barbers, hairdressers, and child care professionals, but what really seemed to drive the numbers in this category were actually the inclusion of gaming occupations, such as casino employees, those involved with dog and horse racing occupations, and similar. The other category was protective service occupations with 25 states, and these included security guards, police officers, and private investigators. Finally, we examined ban the box laws, which prohibit prospective employers from inquiring into a job applicant's criminal history. As shown in green, 9 states prohibit both public and private sector employers from inquiring into criminal history on job applications. 14 states, in yellow, prohibit public sector employers from doing so. And finally, 28 states, in red, do not prohibit any employer from inquiring into criminal history on job applications. So now I'm going to provide some hypothetical examples of how these different laws may operate in practice across different states. So during a stop and frisk, police find half of a marijuana cigarette on Angela's person. After measurement, she was in possession of less than 1 gram of marijuana. In Oregon, you can see that the consequences of a criminal drug conviction are not very great. This is not a criminal charge, there's no mandatory incarceration, and there are relatively few collateral consequences of conviction. However, this point is actually made moot by the fact that in Oregon, possession of less than 1 gram of marijuana is not a punishable offense, so Angela will not be subject to any of the laws in this column. In Arizona, for a first-time offense, Angela will be facing a felony charge with a minimum of 1/3 year in prison. While this conviction will not affect her eligibility for TANF, SNAP, or public housing, it may impact her ability to find employment. She will not be able to receive an occupational license within 3 occupational categories, and any potential employer may ask about her criminal history. In New York, this possession charge is a punishable offense, although the judge is required to sentence it as no more than a civil infraction without mandatory incarceration. However, it's important to remember that these are merely mandatory minimums. Judges may sentence more harshly based on mitigating factors if they choose to do so. So for the sake of argument, potential ramifications of a criminal drug conviction include ineligibility for both TANF and SNAP, inability to qualify for public housing, and inability to receive certain occupational licenses, although employers may not ask her about her criminal history. For our next example, we'll consider Bill, who was subject to an automobile search during which they found a baggie under his seat that included a small amount of crack cocaine. Bill will face criminal charges across all 3 of our example states and a felony for first-time possession in both Missouri and Texas. In Utah, he will not face mandatory incarceration, and his eligibility for TANF, SNAP, and public housing should be unaffected. However, he may face difficulties in finding employment. His ability to receive an occupational license will be limited within 3 occupational categories, and any employer can inquire as to his criminal history. In Missouri, Bill would not face mandatory incarceration for this charge, but he would for a 3rd possession charge. While his eligibility for TANF, SNAP, and public housing will be unaffected, he may face difficulties in finding employment. He will not be able to receive an occupational license within 6 categories, and private employers can inquire as to his criminal history. Finally, in Texas, Bill will face a mandatory sentence of 180 days in prison. This criminal conviction will not affect his eligibility for SNAP or public housing, but it will affect his eligibility for TANF. Bill may also face substantial barriers in finding employment upon release. He will be ineligible for occupational licenses within six categories, and any potential employer can inquire as to his criminal history. For the sake of brevity, I'm not providing an example of methamphetamines because it is treated very similarly under state laws. However, as you can see, the same conduct in different states can result in very different criminal consequences. So in conclusion, state drug possession laws may directly and indirectly affect individual and community-level STD risk. Indirect effects may include those related to socioeconomic status, access to employment, public assistance programs, and affordable housing. Direct effects include those associated with removal from the community, including disruption of sexual networks and community sex ratios, as well as risky sexual behaviors and drug use upon release. Public health researchers could use this framework to evaluate the association between drug possession laws, the consequences of criminal conviction, and STD risk. So at this point, I'd like to return to where we started with our simplified model of thinking about this. So in terms of these laws, the focus is really on the arrow in the upper right-hand corner. How are these sentencing laws facilitating interactions with the criminal justice system, and how are the collateral consequences of conviction mediating the relationship between the criminal justice system, socioeconomic status, drug use, and drug possession? So one thing that can be asked with respect to these laws and outcomes is whether it is better characterized as a feedback loop that amplifies over time and is difficult to get out of, increasing the effect of all of these risk factors on STD outcomes. This framework could be used to evaluate this effect on the ultimate outcome of interest, STD morbidity. Finally, we found that the alignment between criminal drug possession laws and laws affecting the collateral consequences of conviction to be sometimes unpredictable, with relatively minor infractions having extensive impacts in certain cases. This raises some questions as to whether these different laws were considered as a cohesive set of regulations with consideration of how they would operate with one another, and also if they were having unintended consequences, especially as it relates to recidivism. Thus, policymakers could use this framework to evaluate whether drug possession laws are having unintended consequences that affect social conditions, public health, and interaction with the criminal justice system by vulnerable populations. Thank you. So I think we have some time for clarifying questions, if you have any.
Hi. Hey, how are you? Daniel Driffin. Live here in Atlanta, Georgia. I remember you said something about voting rights or whatnot. But I didn't see any response.
Yeah,
for that.
That has been analyzed elsewhere, and it's not. It wasn't something that was in the scope of this project. It's just another thing that's commonly referred to when discussing these sort of collateral consequences of conviction.
Thank you.
Yeah.